The withdrawal was executed successfully before the sky filled with alien battlecraft. His company of Earthling irregulars split up into small groups to make their separate ways to dispersed encampments until they received the call to arms again over the forest vine network. Only Robert's squad headed back toward the heights wherein their cave headquarters lay. That required taking a wide detour, for they were far east in the Moulin Range, and the enemy had set up outposts on several mountain peaks, easily supplied by air and defended with space-based weaponry. One of these stood along their most direct path home, so the Chim scouts led Robert's group down a jungle crevice just north of Lorne Pass. The rope-like transfer vines lay everywhere. They were wonders, certainly, but they made for slow going down here below the heights. Robert had had plenty of time to think. Mostly, he wondered what the Guru were doing coming up here into the mountains at all. Oh, he was glad they came, for it gave the resistance a chance to strike at them. Otherwise, the irregulars might as well spit at the enemy, with their vast, overpowering weaponry. But why were the Guru bothering at all with the tiny guerrilla movement up in the Moulin, when they had a firm grip on the rest of the planet? Was there some symbolic reason, something encrusted in galactic tradition, that required they reduce every isolated pocket of resistance? But even that would not explain the large civilian presence at those mountaintop outposts. The Guru were pouring scientists into the Moulin. They were looking for something. Robert recognized this area. He signaled for a halt. "Let's stop and look in on the guerrillas," he said. His lieutenant, a bespectacled, middle-aged chimmy named Elsie, frowned and looked at him dubiously. "The enemy's gas bots sometimes dose an area without cause, sir, just randomly. We Chims will only be able to rest easy after you're safe underground again." Robert was definitely not looking forward to the caverns, especially since Athaclena wouldn't be back from her next mission for several days. He checked his compass and map. "Come on, the refuge is only a few miles off our path. Anyway, if I know you Chims from the Howlett Center, you must be keeping your precious gorillas in a place that's even safer than the caves." He had her there, and Elsie clearly knew it. She put her fingers to her mouth and trilled a quick whistle, sending the scouts hurrying off in a new direction, to the southwest, darting through the upper parts of the trees. In spite of the broken terrain, Robert made his way mostly along the ground. He couldn't dash pell-mell along narrow branches, not for mile after mile like the Chims. Humans just weren't specialized for that sort of thing. They climbed another side canyon that was hardly more than a split in the side of a mammoth bulwark of stone. Down the narrow defile floated soft wisps of fog, made opalescent by multiple refractions of daylight. There were rainbows, and once when the sun came out behind and above him, Robert looked down at a bank of drifting moisture and saw his own shadow surrounded by a triply colored halo, like those given saints in ancient iconography. It was the glory, an unusually appropriate technical term for a perfect 180-degree reverse rainbow, much rarer than its more mundane cousins that would arch over any misty landscape, lifting the hearts of the blameless and the sinful alike. "If only I weren't so damn rational," he thought. "If I didn't know exactly what it was, I might have taken it as a sign." He sighed. The apparition faded even before he turned to move on. There were times when Robert actually envied his ancestors, who had lived in dark ignorance before the 21st century, and seemed to have spent most of their time making up weird, ornate explanations of the world to fill the yawning gap of their ignorance. Back then, one could believe in anything at all. Simple, deliciously elegant explanations of human behavior. It apparently never mattered whether they were true or not, as long as they were incanted, right? Party lines and Wonderful conspiracy theories abounded. You could even believe in your own sainthood if you wanted. Nobody was there to show you, with clear experimental proof, that there was no easy answer, no magic bullet, no philosopher's stone, only simple, boring sanity. How narrow the golden age looked in retrospect. No more than a century had intervened between the end of the darkness and contact with galactic society. For not quite 100 years, war was unknown to Earth. And now look at us, Robert thought. I wonder, does the universe conspire against us? We finally grow up, make peace with ourselves, and emerge to find the stars already owned by crazies and monsters. No, he corrected himself. Not all monsters. In fact, the majority of galactic clans were quite decent folk. But moderate majorities were seldom allowed to live in peace by fanatics, either in Earth's past or in the 5 galaxies today. Perhaps golden ages simply aren't meant to last. Sound traveled oddly in these closed, rocky confines amid the crisscross lacing of native vines. One moment it seemed as if he were climbing in a world gone entirely silent, as if the rolling wisps of shining haze were folds of cotton batting that enveloped and smothered all sound. The next instant, he might suddenly pick up a snatch of conversation, just a few words, and know that some strange trick of acoustics had carried back to him a whispered remark between 2 of his scouts, possibly hundreds of meters away. He watched them, the Chims. They still looked nervous, these irregular soldiers, who had until a few months ago been farmers, miners, and backwood ecological workers. But they were growing more confident day by day, tougher and more determined. And more feral, Robert also realized, seeing them flit into and out of view among the untamed trees. There was something fierce and wild in the way they moved, in the way their eyes darted as they leaped from branch to branch. One seldom seemed to need words to know what the other was doing. A grunt, a quick gesture, a grimace, these were often more than enough. Other than their bows and quivers and hand-spun weapons pouches, the Chims mostly traveled naked. The softening trappings of civilization, the shoes and factory-made fabrics, were all gone, and with them had departed some illusions. Robert glanced down at himself, bare-shanked, clad in breechcloth moccasins and cloth knapsack, bitten, scratched, and hardening every day. His nails were dirty. His hair had been getting in the way, so he'd cut it off in front and tied it in back. His beard had long ago stopped itching. Some of the ETs think that humans need more uplifting, that we are ourselves little more than animals. Robert leaped for a vine and swung over a dark patch of evil-looking thorns, coming to land in an agile crouch upon a fallen log. It's a fairly common belief among the galactics, and who am I to say they're wrong? There was a scurry of movement up ahead. Rapid hand signals crossed the gaps between the trees. His nearby guards, those directly responsible for his safety, motioned for him to detour along the westward upwind side of the canyon. After climbing a few score meters higher, he learned why. Even in the dampness, he caught the musty, oversweet smell of old coercion dust, of corroding metal, and of death. Soon he reached a point where he could look across the little vale to a narrow scar, already healing under layers of new growth, which ended in a crumpled mass of once sleek machinery, now seared and ruined. There were soft Chim whispers and hand signals among the scouts. They nervously approached and began picking through the debris, while others fingered their weapons and watched the sky. Robert thought he saw jutting white bones amid the wreckage, already picked clean by the ever-hungry jungle. If he had tried to approach any closer, of course, the Chims would have physically restrained him. So he waited until Elsie returned with a report. "They were overloaded," she said, fingering the small black flight recorder. Emotion obviously made it hard for her to bring forth words. "They were trying to carry too many humans to Port Helena the day just after the hostage gas was first used. Some were already sick, and it was their only transport. The flitter didn't clear the peak up there." She gestured at the fog-shrouded heights to the south. "Must have hit the rocks a dozen times to fall this far."
Shall we leave a couple of Chims, sir? A burial detail?"
Robert scuffed the ground. "No, mark it, map it. I'll ask Athaclena if we should photograph it later, for evidence.
Meanwhile, let Garth take what she needs from them.
He turned away. The Chims weren't the only ones finding words hard right now. With a nod, he set the party going again. As he clambered higher, Robert's thoughts burned. There had to be a way to hurt the enemy worse than they had so far. Days ago, on a dark, moonless night, he had watched while 12 selected Chims sailed down onto a Gubru encampment, riding the winds on homemade, virtually invisible paper gliders. They had swooped in, dropped their nitro and gas bombs, and slipped away by starlight before the enemy even knew anything was happening. There had been noise and smoke, uproar and squawking confusion, and no way at all to tell how effective the raid was. Nevertheless, he remembered how he had hated watching from the sidelines. He was a trained pilot, more qualified than any of these mountain Chims for a mission like that. But Athaclena had given firm instructions to which the Neo-Chimps all adhered. Robert's ass was sacred. "It's my own damn fault," he thought, as he scrambled through a dense thicket. By making Athaclena his formal consort, he had given her that added status she had needed to run this small insurrection, and some degree of authority over him as well. No longer could he do as he damn well pleased. So, she was his wife now, in a fashion. Some marriage, he thought. While Athaclena kept adjusting her appearance to look more human, that only served to remind him of what she couldn't do, frustrating Robert. No doubt that was one reason why interspecies consortiums were rare. I wonder what Megan thinks of the news. I wonder if our messenger ever got through.
Psst!
He looked quickly to his right. Elsie stood balanced on a tree branch. She pointed, upslope, to where an opening in the fog exposed a view of high clouds skimming like glass-bottomed boats on invisible pressure layers in the deep blue sky. Underneath the clouds could be seen the tree-fringed slope of a mountain. Narrow curls of smoke spiraled upward from shrouded places on its flanks.
"Mount Fosse,"
Elsie said concisely. And Robert knew at once why the Chims felt this might be a safe place. Safe enough, even for their precious gorillas. Only a few semi-active volcanoes lay along the rim of the Sea of Silmar. Still, all through the Moulin, there were places where the ground occasionally trembled, and at rare intervals, lava poured forth. The range was still growing. Mount Fosse hissed. Vapor condensed in shaggy, serpentine shapes above geothermal vents, where pools of hot water steamed and intermittently burst forth in frothing geysers. The ubiquitous transfer vines came together here from all directions, twisting into great cables as they snaked up the flanks of the semi-dormant volcano. Here they held market in shady, smoky pools, where trace elements that had percolated through narrow trails of hot stone finally entered the forest economy.
"I should have guessed," Robert laughed.
Of course, the Gubru would be unlikely to detect anything here. A few unclothed anthropoids on these slopes would be nothing amid all this heat, spume, and chemical potpourri. If the invaders ever did come to check, the gorillas and their guardians could just melt into the surrounding jungle and return after the interlopers left.
"Whose idea was this?"
he asked, as they approached, under the shade of a high forest canopy. The smell of sulfur grew stronger.
"The general thought of it,"
Elsie answered.
"Figures."
Robert didn't feel resentful. Athaclena was bright, even for a Timbrimi, and he knew he himself wasn't much above human average, if that.
"Why wasn't I told about it?"
Elsie looked uncomfortable.
You never asked, sir. You were busy with your experiments, finding out about the optical fibers and the enemy's detection trick, and..."
Her voice trailed off.
"And?"
he insisted. She shrugged.
"And we weren't sure you wouldn't ever get dosed with the gas sooner or later. If that happened, you'd have to report to town for antidote, you'd be asked questions, and maybe psi-scanned."
Robert closed his eyes, opened them, nodded.
"Okay. For a moment there, I wondered if you trusted me."
"Sir!"
"Never mind," he waved. Athaclena's decision had been proper, logical, once again. He wanted to think about it as little as possible.
"Let's go see the gorillas."
They sat about in small family groups and were easily distinguished at a distance, much larger, darker, and hairier than their neo-chimpanzee cousins. Their big peaked faces, as black as obsidian, bore expressions of peaceful concentration as they ate their meals or groomed each other or worked at the main task that had been assigned them, weaving cloth for the war. Shuttles flew across broad wooden looms, carrying homespun weft over warped strands, snicking and clicking to a rhythm matched by the great ape's rumbling song. The ratcheting and the low atonal grunting followed Robert as he and his party moved toward the center of the refuge. Now and then a weaver would stop work, putting her shuttle aside to wave her hands in a flurry of motion, making conversation with a neighbor. Robert knew sign talk well enough to follow some of the gossip, but the gorilla seemed to speak with a dialect that was quite different from that used by infant chims. It was simple speech, yes, but also elegant in its own way, with a gentle style that was all their own. Clearly, these were not just big chims, but a completely different race, another path taken, a separate route to sentience. The gorilla groups each seemed to consist of a number of adult females, their young, a few juveniles, and one hulking, silver-backed adult male. The patriarch's fur was always gray along his spine and ribs. The top of his head was peaked and imposing. Uplift engineering had altered the neo-gorilla's stance, but the bigger males still had to use at least one knuckle when they walked. Their huge chests and shoulders made them too top-heavy still to move bipedally. In contrast, the lithe gorilla children moved easily on two legs. Their foreheads were rounded, smooth, without the severe sloping and bony brow ridges that would later give them such deceptively fierce countenances. Robert found it interesting how much alike infants of all three races looked: gorillas, chims, and humans. Only later in life did the dramatic differences of inheritance and destiny become fully apparent. Neoteny, Robert thought. It was a classic pre-contact theory that had proven more valid than not. One proposing that part of the secret of sapiency was to remain as childlike as possible for as long as possible. For instance, human beings retained the faces, the adaptability, and when it was not snuffed out, the insatiable curiosity of young anthropoids, even well into adulthood. Was this trait an accident? one which enabled pre-sentient Homo habilis to make the supposedly impossible leap, uplifting himself to starfaring intelligence by his own bootstraps? Or was it a gift from those mysterious beings some thought must have once meddled in human genes, the long-hypothesized missing patrons of humanity? All that was conjecture, but one thing was clear. Other earthly mammals largely lost all interest in learning and play after puberty. But humans, dolphins, and now, more and more with each generation, neo-chimpanzees, retained that fascination with the world with which they entered it. Someday, grown gorillas might also share this trait. Already these members of an altered tribe were brighter and remained curious longer than their fallow earthly kin. Someday their descendants, too, might live out their lifespans forever young. If the galactics ever allow it, that is. Infant gorillas wandered about freely, poking their noses into everything. They were never slapped or chastised, only pushed gently aside when they got in the way, usually with a pat and a chuffed vocalization of affection. As he passed one group, Robert even caught a glimpse of a gray-flanked male mounting one of his females up in the bushes. Three youngsters crawled over the male's broad back, prying at his massive arms. He ignored them, simply closing his eyes and hunkering down, doing his duty by his species. More infants scurried through the breaking foliage to tumble in front of Robert. From their mouths hung strips of some plastic material that they chewed into frayed tatters. Two of the children stared up at him in something like awe. But the last one, less shy than the others, waved its hands in eager, if sloppy, signs. Robert smiled and picked the little fellow up. Higher on the hillside, above the chain of fog-shrouded hot springs, Robert saw other brown shapes moving through the trees. "Younger males," Elsie explained, "and bulls too old to hold a patriarchy. Back before the invasion, the planners at the Howlett Center were trying to decide whether to intervene in their family system. It's their way, yes, but it's so hard on the poor males. A couple years' pleasure and glory, but at the cost of loneliness most of the rest of their lives." She shook her head. "We hadn't made up our minds before the Gubru came. Now, maybe we'll never get the chance." Robert refrained from commenting. He hated the restrictive treaties, but he still had trouble with what Elsie's colleagues had been doing at the Howlett Center. It had been arrogance to take the decision into their own hands. He could see no happy outcome to it. As they approached the hot springs, he saw Chims moving about seriously on various errands. Here one peered into the mouth of a huge gorilla, easily six times her mass, probing with a dental tool. There another patiently taught sign language to a class of 10 gorilla children. "How many Chims are here to take care of them?" "Dr. DeShriver from the center, about a dozen of the Chim techs that used to work with her, plus about 20 guards and volunteers from nearby settlements. It depends on when we sometimes take Rillas off to help in the war." "How do they feed them all?" Robert asked as they descended to the banks of one of the springs. Some of the Chims from his party had arrived ahead of them and were already lounging by the humid bank, sipping at soup cups. A small nearby cave held a makeshift storage chamber where resident workers in aprons were ladling out more steaming mugs.
"It's a problem," Elsie nodded. "The gorillas have finicky digestions, and it's hard to get them the right balance of foods. Even in the restored ranges in Africa, a big silverback needs up to 60 pounds of vegetation, fruit, and insects a day. Natural gorillas have to move around a lot to get that kind of forage, and we can't allow that."
Robert lowered himself to the damp stones and released the gorilla infant, who scampered down to the poolside, still chewing his ragged strip of plastic.
"It sounds like quite a quandary," he said to Elsie.
"Yeah,
Fortunately, Dr. Schultz solved the problem just last year. I'm glad he had that satisfaction before he died.
Robert removed his moccasins. The water looked hot. He dipped a toe and pulled it back quickly.
Ouch! How did he do it?
Beg your pardon?
What was Schultz's solution?
Microbiology, sir.
She looked up suddenly, her eyes bright.
Ah, here they come with soup for us, too.
Robert accepted a cup from a chimney whose apron must have come from cloth woven on the gorilla's looms. She walked with a limp. Robert wondered if she had been wounded in some of the fighting.
Thank you, he said, appreciating the aroma.
He hadn't realized how hungry he was.
Elsie, what do you mean, microbiology?
He sipped delicately.
Intestinal bacteria, symbionts. We all have them. Tiny critters that live in our guts and in our mouths. They're harmless partners, mostly. Help us digest our food in exchange for a free ride.
Ah.
Of course, Robert knew about biosymbionts. Any school kid did.
Dr. Schultz managed to come up with a suite of bugs that helps the rillas eat, and enjoy, a whole lot of native garth vegetation. They...
She was interrupted by a high-pitched little cry, unlike anything an ape might produce.
Robert!
Shrieked a piping voice. He looked up. Robert grinned.
April, little April Woo, how are you, sunshine?
The little girl was dressed like Sheena, the jungle girl. She rode on the left shoulder of an adolescent male gorilla, whose black eyes were patiently gentle. April tipped forward and waved her hands in a quick series of signs. The gorilla let go of her legs, and she climbed up to stand on his shoulder, holding his head for balance. Her guardian chuffed uncomplainingly.
Catch me, Robert!
Robert hurried to his feet. Before he could say anything to stop her, she sprang off, a sun-browned windmill that streamed blonde hair. He caught her in a tangle of legs. For a moment, until he had a sure grip, his heart beat faster than it had in battle or in climbing mountains. He had known the little girl was being kept with the gorillas for safety. To his chagrin, he realized how busy he had been since recovering from his injuries, too busy to think of this child, the only other human free in the mountains.
"Hi, Pumpkin," he said to her. "How are you doing these days? Are you taking good care of the rillas?"
She nodded seriously.
"I've gotta take good care of the rillas, Robert. We gotta be in charge, 'cause there's just us."
Robert gave her a close hug. At that moment, he suddenly felt terribly lonely. He had not realized how badly he missed human company.
"Yep, it's just you and me up here," he said softly.
"You and me and Timbimi Athaklena,"
she reminded him. He met her eyes.
"Nevertheless, you're doing what Dr. DeShriver asks, aren't you?"
She nodded.
"Dr. DeShriver's nice. She says maybe I might get to go see Mommy and Daddy sometime soon."
Robert winced. He would have to talk to Dr. DeShriver about deceiving the youngster. The chim in charge probably could not bear to tell the human child the truth, that she would be in their care for a long time to come. To send her to Port Helena now would be to give away the secret of the gorillas, something even Athaklena was now determined to prevent.
"Take me down there, Robert,"
April demanded with a sweet smile. She pointed to a flat rock where the infant gorilla now capered before some of Robert's group. The chims laughed indulgently at the little male's antics. The satisfied, slightly smug tone in their voices was one Robert found understandable. A very young client race would naturally feel this way toward one even younger. The chims were very proprietary and parental toward the gorillas.
Robert, in turn, felt a little like a father with an unpleasant task ahead of him, one who must somehow break it to his children that the puppy would not remain theirs for long. He carried April across to the other bank and set her down. The water temperature was much more bearable here. No, it was wonderful. He kicked off his moccasins and wriggled his toes in the tingling warmth. April and the baby gorilla flanked Robert, resting their elbows on his knees. Elsie sat by his side. It was a brief, peaceful scene. If a neodolphin were magically to appear in the water, spy-hopping into view with a wide grin, the tableau would have made a good family portrait.
"Hey, what's that you've got in your mouth?"
He moved his hand toward the little gorilla, who quickly shied back out of reach. It regarded him with wide, curious eyes.
"What's he chewing on?"
Robert asked Elsie.
"It looks like a strip of plastic, but what's it doing here? There isn't supposed to be anything here that was manufactured on Garth."
"It's not Garth-made,"
someone said.
They looked up. It was the chimney who had served them their soup.
She smiled and wiped her hands on her apron before bending over to pick up the gorilla infant. It gave up the material without fuss.
"All the little ones chew these strips. They tested safe, and we're absolutely positive nothing about it screams Terran to Goobroo detectors."
Elsie and Robert exchanged a puzzled look.
"How can you be so sure? What is the stuff?"
She teased the little ape, waving the strip before its face until it chirped and grabbed it, popping the well-masticated piece back into its mouth.
"Some of their parents brought shredded bits of it back from our first successful ambush, back at the Howlett Center. They said it smelled good. Now the brats chew it all the time."
She grinned down at Elsie and Robert.
"It's that super plastic fiber from the Goobroo fighting vehicles. You know, that material that stops bullets flat?"
Robert and Elsie stared.
"Hey, Kongi, how about that?"
The chimney cooed at the little gorilla.
"You clever little thing, you. Say, if you like chewing armor plating, how about taking on something really tasty next? How about a city? Maybe something simple like New York?"
The baby lowered the frayed, wet end long enough to yawn, a wide gaping of sharp, glistening teeth. The chimney smiled.
"Yum! You know, I think little Kongi likes the idea."
Chapter 54 Fibbin.
"Hold still now,"
Fibbin told Galet as he combed his fingers through her fur. He needn't have said anything, for although Galet was turned away, presenting her back to him, he knew her face bore a momentary expression of beatific joy as he groomed her. When she looked like that, calm, relaxed, happy with the delight of a simple tactile pleasure, her normally stern countenance took on a glow, one that utterly transformed her somewhat ordinary features. It was only for a minute, unfortunately. A tiny, scurrying movement caught Fibbin's eye, and he pounced after it on instinct before it could vanish into her fine hair.
"Ow!"
she cried, when his fingernails bit a corner of skin, as well as a small, squirming louse. Her chains rattled as she slapped his foot.
"What are you doing?"
"Eating," he muttered as he cracked the wriggling thing between his teeth. Even then, it didn't quite stop struggling.
"You're lying,"
she said, in an unconvincing tone of voice.
"Shall I show it to you?"
She shuddered.
"Never mind. Just go on with what you were doing."
He spat out the dead louse, though for all their captors had been feeding them, he probably could use the protein. In all the thousands of times he had engaged in mutual grooming with other Chims, friends, classmates, the Throop family back on Silmar Island, he had never before been so clearly reminded of one of the ritual's original purposes, inherited from the jungle of long ago, that of ridding another Chim of parasites. He hoped Galet wouldn't be too squeamish about doing the same for him. After sleeping on straw ticks for more than 2 weeks, he was starting to itch something awful. His arms hurt. He had to stretch to reach Galet, since they were chained to different parts of the stone room, and could barely get close enough to do this.
"Well," he said, "I'm almost finished, at least with those places you're willing to uncover. I can't believe the chimmy who said pink to me a couple of months ago is such a prude about nudity."
Galet only sniffed, not even deigning to answer. She had seemed glad enough to see him yesterday when the renegade Chims had brought him here from his former place of confinement. So many days of separate carceral isolation had made them as happy to see each other as long-lost siblings. Now, though, it seemed she was back to finding fault with everything Fibbon did.
"Just a little more," she urged. "Over to the left."
"Gripe, gripe, gripe," Fibbon muttered under his breath. But he complied. Chims needed to touch and be touched, perhaps quite a bit more than their human patrons, who sometimes held hands in public, but seldom more. Fibbon found it nice to have someone to groom after all this time. Almost as pleasurable as having it done to you was doing it for somebody else. Back in college, he had read that humans once restricted most of their person-to-person touching to their sexual partners. Some dark age parents had even refrained from hugging their kids. Those primitives hardly ever engaged in anything that could be likened to mutual grooming. Completely non-sexual, scratching, combing, massaging one another, just for the pleasure of contact, with no sex involved at all. A brief library search had verified this slanderous rumor to his amazement. No historical anecdote had ever brought home to Fibbon so well just how much agnosy and craziness poor human males and femmes had endured. It made forgiveness a little easier when he also saw pictures of old-time zoos and circuses and trophies of the hunt. Fibbon was pulled out of his thoughts by the sound of keys rattling. The old-style wooden door slid open. Someone knocked, and then walked in. It was the chimmy who had brought them their evening meals. Since being moved here, Fibbon had not learned her name, but her heart-shaped face was striking, and somehow familiar. Her bright zip-suit was of the style worn by the band of probationers that worked for the Gubru. The costume was bound by elastic bands at ankles and wrists, and a holo-projection armband picted outstretched bird's talons a few centimeters into space.
"Someone's coming to see both of you,"
the female probie said lowly, softly.
"I thought you'd want to know. Have time to get ready."
Galet nodded coolly.
"Thank you."
He hardly glanced at the chimmy. But Fibbon, in spite of his situation, watched their jailer's sway as she turned and walked away.
"Damn traitors," Galet muttered.
She strained against her slender chain, rattling it.
"Oh, there are times when I wish I were a Chen. I'd...
Fibbon looked up at the ceiling and sighed.
Galet strained to turn and look at him. "What? You've maybe got a comment?"
Fibbon shrugged.
"Sure. If you were a Chen, you just might be able to bust out of that skinny little chain. But then they wouldn't have used something like that if you were a male Chim, would they?"
He lifted his own arms as far as they would go, barely enough to bring them into her view. Heavy links rattled.
The chafing hurt his bandaged right wrist, so he let his hands drop to the concrete floor.
"I guess there were other reasons she wishes she was male," came a voice from the doorway.
Pippin looked up and saw the probationer called Iron Grip, the leader of the renegades. The Chim smiled theatrically as he rolled one end of his waxed mustache, an affectation Pippin was getting quite sick of.
"Sorry, I couldn't help but overhear that last part, folks."
Galet's upper lip curled in contempt.
"So you were listening. So what? All that means is you're an eavesdropper as well as a traitor."
The powerfully built Chim grinned.
"Shall I go for voyeur also? Why don't I have you two chained together, Ought to make for lots of amusement. You like each other so much."
Galet snorted. She pointedly moved away from Pippin, shuffling over to the far wall. Pippin refused to give the fellow the pleasure of a response. He returned Iron Grip's gaze evenly.
"Actually," the probationer went on in a musing tone, "it's pretty understandable a chimmy like you wishing she was a chin, especially with that white breeding card of yours. Why, a white card's damn near wasted on a girl." "What I find hard to figure," Iron Grip said to Pippin, "is why you two have been doing what you were doing, running around playing soldier for the man. Hard to figure. You with a blue card, her with a white. Geez, you two could do it any time. She's pink, with no pills, no asking her guardian, no by your leave from the uplift board. All the kids you ever want, whenever you want them."
Galet offered the Chim a chilled stare.
"You are disgusting."
Iron Grip colored. It was especially pronounced with his pale, shaved cheeks.
"Why? Because I'm fascinated by what's been deprived me? With what I can't have?"
Pippin growled.
"More like with what you can't do."
The blush deepened. Iron Grip knew his feelings were betraying him. He bent over to bring his face almost even with Pippin's.
"Keep it up, college boy. Who knows what you'll be able to do once we've decided your fate."
He grinned.
Pippin wrinkled his nose. "You know, the color of a chin's card isn't everything. For instance, even you'd probably get more girls if you just used a mouthwash once in a while."
He grunted and doubled over as a fist drove into his abdomen.
"You pay for your pleasures,"
Pippin reminded himself, as his stomach convulsed and he fought for breath. Still, from the look on the traitor's face, he must have struck pay dirt. Iron Grip's reaction spoke volumes.